Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 102. Anna, the Man on Love. July 24th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
At the very end of my therapy, I learned another very important thing, and this was about love. My therapist said to me, look, when you're in love, head over heels, as a matter of fact, that is the moment to be a little bit suspicious, because it's no good throwing yourself at somebody, and you really have to also carefully look at that other person and try to look at it at that person realistically and ask yourself a couple of questions. What is this? What kind of a person is she? What kind? Who is she? What is she like? How does she handle herself? And is that a kind of person that you like and you can picture yourself being with? And so as a result of that, of internalizing that and spending a couple of years really learning that, I was matured and well-balanced enough that when I finally met my wife, that I was able to start off in a feasible way and then take on all the difficult thresholds, switching profession and language. Also, for the first time, I started living together with somebody, and then we got married, and then we moved to Israel. So in the course of 1 year, I changed everything. I changed my language, my country, my job, my profession, and my civil state, as we call it, from being unmarried to married. Ooh. And really took the dedication of a well-balanced person to really know, okay, I want to take this on, and then take all the adverse that comes on such a bumpy road. And there, my therapy definitely helped me a lot.
That was the voice of my guest, Anna, a faithful Shrink Wrap Radio listener who, after 10 years of marriage, is still very much in love with his wife. According to his blog, he was born in the Netherlands in 1966, moved to Israel in 1998. He says he has dabbled in creative writing since 1983. He studied and taught law 1984 to 1998, and he switched to high tech in 1997. He's the father of two kids and is happily married with interests in languages, history, literature, and culture. On the event of his wife's birthday, he finds himself reflecting on love. Here's the interview. Well, I'm talking here with the person that I know as Anna, and in English it looks like Anne, A-N-N-E. Anne is a Man, and that's the name of your blog, right?
Right.
And so welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. You've been a long-time listener.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so now you're on the other side of the mic or the speaker or whatever.
Yes, a dream come true.
Yes, and I want to bring our audience in on why we're doing this here. There's quite a bit of background, because you've been one of the most dedicated of Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, and you've been so dedicated not only to exchange a lot of email with me, but also to start a blog in which in large part seems to be devoted to reviewing both this podcast, Shrink Wrap Radio, and my other podcast, Wise Counsel. Really appreciated that kind of dedication.
And then you're welcome.
And then you contacted me and you said, hey, my wife is about to have a birthday, and I would really like it if you could interview me a little bit, and I could turn it into a birthday surprise for her. We could talk about our relationship, and it would be a birthday surprise. And so that was the stimulus for us getting together right now. So let's do that. Say a little bit more. You were telling me off mic a little bit about how you plan to present this. You said there's a party coming up. in the beginning of August. Let's start there.
Okay, well, there's this, the party, and my wife asked everybody who's going to come to the party to give her a present, something cultural that one particularly likes and wants to give to her. And so it was obvious to me immediately that I was going to give her a load of podcasts. I have been giving her a couple of podcasts because I like it so much, and she's got her MP3 player and sometimes listens to it and then is very, very excited about it. And she's excited about my blog, but hasn't come around to really connect to the podcasts as such. And so I wanted to give her some more. And I was thinking of Shrink Wrap Radio, because not only is Shrink Wrap Radio one of my favorite podcasts, I think it is a podcast that shows many of the characteristics of what a podcast can be. It is a, well, maybe we can talk about more about that if you like.
Yeah, let's keep the focus on your wife here. Now, what's her name, by the way?
Her name is Rachel. I say Rachel, but you can say Rachel. That's probably easier for you.
It would be easier for me. So I think right now, part of your plan is to play maybe part of this at that party. So I think right now, certainly I want to say happy birthday, Rachel.
Yes, happy birthday. Yom Hulet Sameach.
There you go. So how long have the two of you been married?
Okay, well, we have been married for nearly 10 years now.
Okay.
And we have known each other for about 13 years.
Uh-huh.
And
how did the two of you meet?
Okay, so she worked at the University of Amsterdam as she was working on her PhD. And I was a lecturer at the same university. And though the both of us were working for the Faculty of Law. It's a very large faculty, and we were situated in different buildings because her specialty is international law, and she was sitting at the Europe Institute, and I was teaching at the time constitutional law, and that was in the other side. But chance had it that I had to teach one semester European law, and I was temporarily moved to her side of the building, and that's where we got to meet. And in her section, it was customary to go and have lunch with the whole bunch together. And this is how we met and how I got to talking. And she stood out for me, and I stood out for her. And things developed.
Yeah, well, what was it about her that stood out for you? That first impression.
Yeah. Well, she was very different, and I must add here, you know, we're talking here at the University of Amsterdam, but she, even though she has a Dutch nationality, she is an Israeli, and so she looks different and talks different from what you would regularly run into in a Dutch law faculty. So,
okay.
First of all, she stood out as somebody foreign, somebody different, with a different style in conversation and speech, but very fascinating, very attractive.
Very attractive, she was to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
attractive in many ways. I think she's beautiful, but I think also that there was something very fascinating about how she expressed herself and the kind of opinions that she had. There is this funny incident when she was attacking us for having a monarchy. The Netherlands are a monarchy.
Uh-huh.
How can this be, you know, in a modern democracy times? How can you have a monarchy? And I was the only one who agreed with her. And this is indeed very much of a minority standpoint in the Netherlands. And it's a bit of a taboo subject. Nobody puts the monarchy to discussion. And it's not considered to be very important. And as a specialist in constitutional law, I can say that it is not very important. But still, there are some minor things. And this is something that fascinated me, that she was not afraid of taking this on, expressing herself, and if everybody was almost getting angry at her, she just stood there, and I thought that was wonderful.
Interesting. That somehow fits with my stereotype of the Israeli temperament. that they will stand up and kind of make a stand and be somewhat confrontational. And it sounds like a combustible mixture, the two of you, both lawyers, both very educated people and lawyers. I can just imagine what your fights must be like.
Yes.
You're quiet.
Well, this is something I've been thinking about because I think, you know, for the purpose of Shrink Wrap Radio, I think what is interesting is to talk here about love.
Yeah.
And I recall one of your shows where your guest, and I forgot who it was. I only think I recall that it was a woman, a psychologist, who said to you, well, now we touch on the L word, as if to indicate that love is even in psychology a bit of a taboo subject or a problematic subject, and you'd rather, you know, cut this apart and talk about maybe relationships or other aspects. And when I try to understand how love came about between my wife and me, and how we got together and mm-hmm. stayed together and made this work really well to the extent that I'm so excited about this and feel that she's the light of my life, and I am so happy that I am the light of hers.
Yeah, I'm so impressed.
And this is not very easy to establish.
It's true.
When you take into the account this combustible starting point that you just described.
Yeah.
Because it may be a stereotype that you have about Israelis.
I'm sure it is.
It is true that when you grow up, I speak now a little bit as a sociologist. I have a bit of a background in sociology. And when, as a person, you are formed within the culture in which you are growing up.
Sure.
And this gives you a certain palette, a certain range of conversational styles, and the conversational style generally among Israelis is much more confrontational, much more tell it like it is, mm-hmm. also an expressional style is much more speaking in hyperboles, mm-hmm. and the Dutch maybe are also a little bit like telling it like it is, but speak in diminutives, in understatements,
uh-huh.
and this was very difficult because it is nice, it is fascinating when you're having lunch with the colleagues and you're having a heated discussion about the Dutch monarchy. But if you're discussing something that is emotionally close to you and then she is expressing herself in a way that I have never learned to deal with and have not even learned to accept, then that is quite a threshold to come past.
Yeah.
And when we started out dating, as a matter of fact, we kept on saying to each other, what are we doing? This cannot possibly work.
Really?
Because of the cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. And yet?
And yet it did.
And
maybe now that we have made it to work, then it is also by virtue of having mastered all those thresholds and coming to fully accept and appreciate each other's styles and learning a bit from each other and having become fine-tuned together, that this is, you know, that this is just this one wonderful experience. But it definitely didn't come here overnight.
It didn't.
And the great thing is that it keeps on developing. So it's not just something that we have established and from here on it's like a free ride. No, it keeps on, and that's also what keeps it alive and great.
Backing it up just a little bit,
yeah.
how did you know that she was the one, or at what point? You know, because I think often there are questions in our mind, you know, before we get married. It's such
yeah.
a big step. And there can be a lot of fear and a lot of doubt and questioning. At what point did you have a strong feeling of, you know, this is the one for me?
Well, I did have that feeling very early on, but not in such a way that it was completely without doubt.
Probably
and,
very few
I think
of those,
this is something that probably everybody recognizes,
sure.
that We do not have a single voice in our head, or we do not have a single point of view, a single opinion. So when I was getting to know her better and we became befriended, I was immediately in love with her and of course wanted to see her as much as I could and date with her. But even while going through that excitement, I knew that I was taking a bite that was too big for me to chew. And what made things more complicated is, okay, so we got to know each other in a working environment. It's not that you hit it off immediately, so it took a couple of months, and that's when I went back to my section, and so we were separated in the building, and that was actually quite good for us because it allowed us to see each other on a private basis without the colleagues noticing it and started asking awkward questions. But it just so happened that that was when she finished her PhD, and she obtained a scholarship to do a postdoctoral in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So she was about to leave the country when we hit it off, and we had about 6 weeks together, and then she was going to go there, and maybe this was just going to be one nice fling, and we should leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And so it was when she was going to Ann Arbor that I decided, yes, but this went so well, as good as it could go, I want to investigate it. So this is not a point at which I was saying, I know that she is the one, but I did know this. I want to know everything there is to know about her and try every possible conceivable way of building up something with her, and together with the love race, the relationship was also a very deep friendship developing. And so when she was in Ann Arbor, I tried to I called her as much as I could, and I it was in the middle of the 1990s when conservative legal professionals such as myself had hardly ever touched a computer. So that was it, the first time that I took an email account and we started emailing, and then I just, you know, I invested all the time and money that I had into visiting her as much as I could in Michigan. So I spent 3 extended stays in Michigan, and it was when we were together in the United States at some point that we sat down, that we literally sat down. I recall this, we were on a weekend, a long weekend in Chicago, and we sat down in this cafe over a cup of coffee, and we said, okay, so this is the fling. We can see that it is developing into more. So how are we in the world going to make this work? Where are we going to live? How are we going to combine these two nationalities? And what if we want to live in Israel? I have to learn the language. I have to find a way of earning an income in the country. And so we started talking about very practical things.
Yeah, that sounds like a big step.
Apart from getting to know her, getting to know her background, because she had been living for 10 years in the Netherlands. There was not much that I had to teach her about the Dutch language or the Netherlands culture. She knew everything about it. Mm-hmm. But I was a blank when it came to Israel.
So that was a very, I would have thought that'd be a very big and perhaps scary step for you.
Well, it was.
Yeah,
but then then the adventurous part in me comes up and says, "Okay, you know, I can see that this is that." Then, indeed, the feeling became more and more. She is the one, and at this point, I don't care what I have to sacrifice. I'm willing to do that. Wow. And so I took up learning Java development in order to be able to do something technical. I tried to study some Hebrew, but that didn't take off until we actually started living in Israel, which was about 2-3 years later.
Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't anchored this in terms of how old you are. Maybe we should let people know.
Okay, my wife is going to be 45.
I'm not sure you should have said that.
That's no problem. Okay. And I am 41.
Okay, great. Just so that people know, you know, that I'm not talking to a teenager and I'm not talking to an old man. This is great.
Right.
Okay, so boy, that was a big step then to for you to immigrate to Israel and move from your profession of having taught in the university law and then sociology, and then to move into technology. That was also very brave of you. So you were learning two languages at the same time. You were learning Java and Hebrew.
Yes. Well, I didn't do that simultaneously. When I was doing the Java course, the Hebrew was at a low pace. And once I made it to Israel, I had finished the course. I had my certificate, and I was lucky to immediately find a job and even get my employer to agree that I would study the language in the mornings and I would come in the afternoons and evenings to work at the office.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke about that a friendship was developing, and so how do you see the relationship between love and friendship? Are they the same thing, do you think, or do they overlap? Are they different? What's your take on that? And I know you're not an expert, but just from your own experience.
From my own experience, for me, it is the same. Mm-hmm. And I can see that for other people it works differently, and it is something that has confused me at times in the past. But for me, it is the same. And I can see that why it works so well between Rachel, my wife, and me, Rachel, as I call her, is because of something that it was immediately clear, you know, at the time when we were having this lunch with our colleagues and she was upset about the Dutch monarchy, and I said, well, you know, actually you're right. There is something between us that in spite of all the cultural differences, but we have a lot of the same opinions and a lot of the same tastes and preferences.
Yes.
And and so there is this constant excitement when we get to talk about any which subject that, you know, we speak the same language at a humane level, at an intellectual level. And so this is something that never stops being exciting, and we never stop appreciating each other. And when I was younger, or before I even met her, I had had a couple of good friendships, and I had always said to myself, this is what I want in a relationship. I want, in addition to the love aspect, you know, the excitement and the sexual attraction and the relationship, I want this as well, that you're intellectually fascinated all the time and want to read the same books and discuss it and go to the movies and enjoy the more or less the same things and never stop being excited about that and have endless ground for conversations.
Well, that's what I hear in you, is I hear real intellectual passion, a passion for life and a passion for reading and studying and thinking. And I know you've held my feet to the fire more than once, wanting to engage.
Happy to do that.
Yeah, wanting to engage me in some very thoughtful discussion. So you're truly lucky to have found a partner who's willing to join you in that passion.
Yes, and that is something that we both appreciate, because we have in our 30s when we met, or I was about to become 30. We had had enough experience to appreciate that, to know that that was no small feat to establish that.
Yes. Now, from prior emails, I know that there was that part of your interest in psychology may derive from the fact that you've had some experience being a client in psychotherapy, and I don't know if that was in couples work or individually, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what that experience meant to you and whether or not it's helped you to be in the place in your relationship that you are now.
Well, first of all, it helped. It helped a lot. And it was prior to the moment that I met Rachel. I was working on my PhD, and I was and you also know what a lonely experience that is. And I was really getting stuck at the time, existentially. I had to do so much work, and I was at a loss. What am I doing this for? And I felt sure. I was not happy with my life. And
yeah.
The effect of this was that I was constantly tired. And so the doctor at the university, I went to see the doctor and said, "Look, I have trouble doing my work because I'm tired and I'm not focused all the time." And she took looked me up and said, "Well, you know, you probably have you're physically completely fine. Maybe you should see a psychologist." And that's when I went to a psychologist. And then I decided, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this right, and I'd rather do this outside the realm of the university. That it's not my my employer who is involved in this, and it's just my own initiative.
Yes.
And I did about 30 sessions of psychotherapy, and it, this was mainly focused on establishing meaning in my life. I remember that I had to read this book by Viktor Frankl.
Oh, yes, Man's Search for Meaning.
Exactly.
Yes.
It was a wonderful book.
Oh,
that
yes.
Was, that really gives so much practical insight of how to go about. And it's really about having a couple of things in life that you are passionate about and you want to live for.
Yes.
And it was at the time that I also already knew, but defined it for myself once more, that if there is anything in my life that I really, really want, it is to have a meaningful relationship. And it was not very easy for me to establish that at the time. And it was because of the intellectual passion that you described.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had a tendency of whatever woman I was dating, sort of, you know, overwhelming her with all the excitement that was in me with the books and the movies and the philosophy and so usually they wanted to keep some distance, even though they were fascinated by the intellect but didn't want to get too involved, and that was entirely confusing with me.
Uh-huh.
And so at the very end of my therapy, I learned another very important thing, and this was about love. My therapist said to me, "Look, when you're in love, head over heels, as a matter of fact, that is the moment to be a little bit suspicious, because it's no good throwing yourself at somebody, and you really have to also carefully look at that other person and try to look at it at that person realistically and ask yourself a couple of questions. What is this? What kind of a person is she? What kind? Who is she? What is she like? How does she handle herself? And is that a kind of person that you like and you can picture yourself being with?" And so, as a result of that, of internalizing that, and spending a couple of years really learning that, I was matured and well balanced enough that when I finally met my wife, that I was able to start off in a feasible way, and then take on all the difficult thresholds, switching profession and language. Also, for the first time, I started living together with somebody, and then we got married, and then we moved to Israel. So, in the course of 1 year, I changed everything. I changed my language, my country, my job, my profession, and my civil state, as we call it, from being unmarried to married. And really took the dedication of a well-balanced person to really know, okay, I want to take this on and then take all the adverse that comes on such a bumpy road. And there my therapy definitely helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Even though it was over, it was past, still you had learned things in the course of it that helped you as you moved on.
Well, isn't that what therapy is all about?
Ideally,
that's at least
yes.
What my therapist said. She always said, I'm here to make myself completely dispensable.
Yeah, good, good. Now, was there also a religious transition where, I don't know if you were born a Jew, were you religiously a Jew? Was your wife?
Well, my wife is Jewish.
But in terms of Judaism, was she, observant of Judaism?
Well, we're both secular, and so this is also an intellectual point at which we meet each other and communicate very well. But we definitely come from very different backgrounds. She comes from a Jewish background, and I come from a Christian background, Protestant Christian background.
Okay, and how did your family take to that? And then how did her family take to that?
Well, I must say that her family took it much easier than my family did, mm-hmm. and maybe not so much as the Jewish part, but more the culturally different part, and the very decision to go and live in Israel, which mm-hmm. to them is pretty strange, if not irresponsible. Why go and move into the war zone and, of all things, build a family there? We have two children, and not go and live in the Garden of Eden below the sea.
Yes. So that raises a whole other set of issues that I continue to be interested in, which is, what life is like there in Israel, where you are, where there's that constant sense of danger. At least being on the outside, that's my sense of it. Do you have a constant sense of danger where you live, or not?
Well, it has quieted down a little bit. We had the second intifada, which started around the year 2000 when I had been living for about 2 years in Israel. And that was 5 years tension constantly at a certain level, and on and off it was going really high. The great thing is that I love to adapt myself here in Israel. I really am very dedicated to becoming a part of society, and people are usually pretty surprised to find that not only am I not originally Israeli, I'm not even Jewish. That's almost inconceivable. So I blend in very well, and one of the things that that you see around you is that people have learned to deal with this kind of tension. And so I immediately mimicked that and learned how to do that. And, mm-hmm. and the way to deal with these kinds of tensions when there is a war on, or when there is a constant threat of terrorist attacks, you become very practical. You focus on the practical things of life, and you also take on a practical view of the terrorist threat, and you have to see it in the proportion that it is. And even though a terrorist attack is something that is completely out of the ordinary and it should be completely abnormal and not happen at all, but okay, it is here, but the danger, the statistical danger, the chances of getting something, suffering from a terrorist attack is still much lower than getting a car accident.
Well, that's good. And I suppose,
and so when you're focusing on practical issues, you have to be careful on the road, not forget that you have to be a responsible driver,
yes.
Which is something that you have to be in the Netherlands and the United States just as much as you have to be in Israel. And, apart from that, and this is really something that is constantly in your consciousness, but it's not that bothering, is that you're aware and you're looking around, and if somebody acts suspiciously, you do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to do something about it, knowing what to do, is also something that takes out the tension a lot. And I think it is much more it's much easier to get into a panic when you don't know what to do. And from the outside, it looks like, wow, you wouldn't know what to do.
Yes. Well, you know, I think many people outside the country look at the U.S. and they have the impression that everybody here is carrying a gun and there's constant violence because that's what they see in the newspapers and
exactly.
That's, you know, and that's what they what they hear about this country. That's what they see in Hollywood movies. But in fact,
exactly. And when I get these kinds of questions about Israel, then I say exactly this: we don't live in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
The practical life is entirely. It's a boring banality just as much as anywhere else, and the same way goes around in the different direction. When any Israeli tells me, "What, you gave up living in Amsterdam and you come to this rotten place? You're out of your mind." And then I say, "Look, in Amsterdam we also do not live in the newspaper and this fancy liberal town where you can get stoned without being in trouble with the law. That's not practical life in Amsterdam."
Yeah.
That's what people think, and maybe some tourists, that's what they make make it, but no. So don't make that something wonderful or a lush of whatever. No, it's life. My first impression of Israel was also when I came to visit here for the first time, and my wife asked me, okay, so what do you think? And she was really, you know, a little bit tense. Okay, what's coming up? And I said, well, it's a normal country. You know, I wasn't excited about it, and I wasn't afraid about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is pretty healthy.
Yes, yes. So maybe we should begin to think about wrapping it up here. And
yes.
So what would be your advice to others out there who are looking for love and maybe who haven't found it yet or who are having difficulties in relationship? What have you learned that you could pass on?
Oh, wow. And you talking of wrapping it up, and you're opening this kind of worms. Okay, well, let me try to put it in a couple of things that I've been thinking about prior to this interview. And I say, look, love is something that is very special. It really triggers our imagination and our aspirations. There is this song by Joni Mitchell. It's called A Song for Sharon, and there is this line in it when she sings, love stimulated my illusions more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that is both the strength and the weakness of this wonderful thing, love.
Yes.
It, for one, it's a great stimulant of our imagination, of our aspiration, and it's really good. It's healthy for a person to have something to aspire to. At the same time, it stimulates our illusions. We begin to aspire to some kind of picture that is not realistic, and so we can also trick ourselves. And if I have to give advice to people, it's a double advice, is to both embrace love and not embrace it too vehemently. Is to cherish the aspiration and yet at the same time stay firmly embedded on the ground and understand that in order to obtain love, you have to build a relationship, and a relationship is about very practical stuff, about communication, about acceptance, about knowing that the other person is not some ideal, about knowing that you yourself are not some kind of an ideal, and when you decide to stick together, it is also in spite of a lot of things, and you have to work on this, and then comes the appreciation that at some point you can suddenly feel that emotional surge and say, wow, yeah, I'm so attached to this person, and say, well, what I say about my wife is she's the light of my life. It's not that I think that she's some kind of angel that descended from heaven into my life. No, she's a real person, but that makes it more so.
Well, boy, that's very well said. And Rachel,
thank you.
Rachel, if you're still listening, I think you're very, first of all, happy birthday again. And congratulations to you for landing such a passionate and loving man as you have here in Anna, and someone who is so devoted to you. And so I think you are both very fortunate and a wonderful example to all of the rest of us. And Anna, I want to thank you for being my guest, for being willing to come on here.
You're welcome.
You are, in some ways, you're representative of this wonderful audience that I have of very intelligent and articulate people. And so it's particularly meaningful to me to have someone of your intelligence and accomplishment be such a strong supporter.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I think that's part of the success of your show, that it is also stimulated by the audience, and that's what is great about the modern internet age, that the culture is going in a two-way direction.
Yes, and you know, you gave me some feedback on the anniversary show, and most of it was positive, but you said, you know, the one thing that you didn't do was acknowledge your audience. And when you said
yes,
that, I
felt very strongly about that.
Well, you know, I had intended to do that, and somehow in the moment, as a matter of fact, Jerry and I had to record that show.
You ran long.
we had to record that show twice. We did that whole show just as long as that, and there was a noise problem that I had not been aware of, and it would have been such a horrible show to put out there. I said, no way can I do it. And fortunately, Jerry was willing to do it again, even though he had been in the throes of back pain and may have to have surgery for his back. I think he's planning to have surgery.
Okay, well, Jerry, good luck with that.
Yes.
Get well soon.
Yeah, so when he listened back to the show, you know, and this may be because he was in pain, but he listened back and he said, oh, that was boring. That was horribly boring. So I'm hoping it wasn't that boring. And I did have it in mind to acknowledge how honored, you know, you can't have a podcast if you don't have listeners. And right. So there's a complementary relationship there. The podcast is only as good as the audience. And I have a wonderful audience.
I have to say that is one of the exciting things of being an audience to a podcast as opposed to being an audience to a radio show.
Yes.
Because I have made a habit of contacting the podcast, the one who makes the podcast, and usually, just like you, they respond, they're so happy to hear from me. And,
yeah.
And so I become part of the show much more. It's becoming much more intimate, and that's fantastic. And it's a dimension you don't have with regular radio.
And that's a perfect wrap. You are part of the show. Thanks for being my guest tonight on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Shrink Wrap Radio listener Anna. And I hope I'm saying his name right. I never know for sure. In English, it's spelled A-N-N-E. And so lots of people read it as Anne, which is, he tells me this is something that's plagued him all his life, but he's not felt like he should change his name. So he's stuck with it. But that's why he's named his blog Anne is a Man, or Anna is a Man. Anna is a Man, or Anna is a Man. I still have a bad cold with a cough, and maybe you can hear it in my voice, so I apologize for that. I decided to make this interview a regular Shrink Wrap Radio offering rather than just a private message for Anna to give to his wife. I mean, we could have just left it there. But I really wanted to share it with my wider audience because, for a number of reasons, I like building the Shrink Wrap Radio community, the sense of community, by every now and then putting on a listener who has something relevant to contribute. And I like being able to give them, and perhaps all of you, the Alice in Wonderland feeling that it's possible to step into the other side of the mirror, to move from listener to podcast star. Because I know a lot of you out there have a lot of expertise. And Anna is especially thoughtful and also very passionate about ideas and about life. Beyond that, I'm impressed by his devotion to his wife. He's a good role model for me and perhaps for others out there. and also because his experience in psychotherapy helped bring him to the maturity to enter into such a long-term, committed, and loving relationship. And that, again, is good modeling for any listeners out there who might be questioning the value of psychotherapy or counseling for themselves. I wouldn't be the first person to observe that it's easier to be a loving, spiritual person as a monk than to do it in the rough and tumble of a relationship. Our spouse ends up being our best and also our toughest teacher. Anna wanted me to give a solid academic discourse on the psychological importance of love to add further justification to the interview. I'm not sure I can do that to the level of his expectations, other than to note that our need to love and to be loved is both one of our most important and powerful aspects of our human existence, and for most of us also, one of the most challenging.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Let's go straight to our Frapper Map. I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Dawn in Dubois, Wyoming, who writes, I enjoy hearing from such a variety of guests. Thanks for a great show. Well, Dawn, thanks for that and for being, as far as I know, my one and only listener in Wyoming, at least the only one on the Frapper Map. And there are lots of other states not represented on the Frapper Map, for example, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Montana, Kansas, Oklahoma, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, to name just a few. I don't know if Frapper drops them after a while. I know I've had a listener in Montana, for example, but maybe he never bothered to put himself on the Frapper Map. So, hey, if you're in any one of these states or some others, how about putting yourself on the map? And if you're not on our map, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Now, last time I urged you to go over to www.wisecounselpodcast.com to hear my other podcast series, Interview with John Fleming, MD, on his book, Preventing Addiction, What Parents Must Know to Immunize Their Kids Against Drug and Alcohol Addiction. Well, Anna took me to task there for not warning listeners that the man offers potentially dangerous advice. Indeed, I should let you know that I did find some of his recommendations draconian, to say the least, such as giving your teenagers breathalyzer tests whenever they come home and putting a low jack on their car so that you can track where they are at all times. I didn't realize until it was too late that I was interviewing someone from a fairly extreme fundamentalist position. However, I did want to treat him with respect as my guest nonetheless. I think I allowed just enough of my skepticism to come through. You might want to go over to Wise Counsel Podcast just to check out this controversy and to read Anna's post there, as well as mentalhelp.net's response to his post. And by the way, I'm sure Anna would love you to check out his blog at www.annisaman.blogspot.com. That's annisaman.blogspot.com. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the sponsors of this show, Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout for GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase.
Hi, this is David Gordon from Norfolk, Virginia, at the IASD Dream Conference, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
It was wonderful to get to sit in on another workshop by David Gordon at the recent Dreams Conference, and I'm currently enjoying his book on mindful dreaming very much. So let's take a dip into the mail. And I hope I'm speaking loud enough for you to be able to understand me, I'll tell you, it's hard putting the edge in my voice that normally I would be able to project due to the cold. First, we hear from Stuart, who writes, I promised myself that when you got to the 100th episode, I would make contact and support your unique and creative idea. I've been in the silent majority for the last couple of years since flipping over from another podcast. Wonder what that one was. As a complete amateur with no experience or interest in getting any academic standpoint on this subject, it has proven to be and continues to be a good use of an hour a week. I look forward very much to the intelligent and provoking discussion. For the most part, I would have to say 8 out of 10, with the ignorance being on my side. Otherwise, it would be 10 out of 10, although I find it hard to hook to the enthusiasm you guys have for dreams. I've even bought, yet to read, Philip Zimbardo's Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. I hope I can understand it. In at the deep end, I guess, and thank you for the great effort you're putting in. It has opened up a new area of interest. Well, Stuart, I'm glad to hear that. And I think you'll find Philip Zimbardo's book very readable, not too much at the deep end at all. He doesn't use a lot of jargon that you would have difficulty understanding. Stuart also said, P.S., Using Juice episode number 72, Soul Medicine, has some type of downloading issue. That is, it never does download. So thanks for alerting me to that, Stuart. And I was able to fix it right away. And if anybody else out there encounters shows that aren't downloading properly, be sure to let me know, you know, because we redid the whole website. And when you redo 100 shows, there are bound to be some mistakes that creep in. Longtime listener Cody wrote in to say, hi, Dave, I really enjoyed your anniversary show. You find a great recipe to do the show. Your friend and you had a very enjoyable summary conversation. And so that was great to hear, Cody. I really appreciate that feedback. And as you know, Jerry was a little worried that we were perhaps boring. I think it may have been the meds he was on that made him think that, rather than that they made him boring. I didn't think he was boring, nor did I think I was boring, for that matter. Hope not. Next, we hear from Chris, who writes, in response to the interview on dreaming that I did with Bob Haas, writes, Hi, Dr. Dave, I just finished listening to your Bob Haas interview. So interesting. Curiously, he stated our language areas are shut down during dreams and that the brain uses its own special language during dreams. Interesting, because I've had many dreams where I've had conversations with people. Also, I'm learning Japanese right now, and in a recent dream, I recited a list of Japanese vocabulary words to a Japanese music composer. Is Bob Haas trying to say that if you speak words in a dream, that the language centers will be turned off and therefore the language words of the dream are a brain internal meaning language different from normally produced spoken vocal language? Also, are foreign languages processed by all the same language areas as the first language? I think I've heard that if a person has specific damage to the brain that sometimes one cannot speak their first language, but can speak their second. True? You know, I think that there may be something to that, in fact. He says, some stutterers can sing without stuttering, I hear. So interesting. Thanks for reading and hopefully responding. Have an interesting day, Chris. Well, Chris, I think I will forward your email to Bob Haas, as a matter of fact, and we'll let him respond. Both to you, maybe he'll respond to you directly, and also to me. I think when Bob refers to, you know, I can't answer entirely for him, but I think when he says that the brain has its own special language during dreams, I think he's referring to the fact that dreams are largely visual and largely metaphorical. That's the language that he's referring to, that it's a kind of poetic, associative language. But we'll have to let him answer that question for sure. And indeed, most dreams seem to be very visual and to have very little in the way of spoken conversation. Often people have the sense that there was a conversation, but they don't remember really explicit dialogue often. Not that it never happens. And just what's going on in the brain at such times as it is happening, I really don't know. Now, actually, that last email jogged my memory of a voicemail that I received that raises a similar question.
Dr. Dave, this is Elaine with a psychology thought from a listener to a psychologist. On the subject of not being able to recall dreams, could it be that dreaming is simply thoughts and thoughts that free associate and therefore do not get stored in memory, sort of like a computer has memory, but this is simply thoughts in progress or the process of thinking while we're asleep? I've always wondered about this and thought I'd pass on my thought. Have a good day. Bye.
Elaine, that's an excellent question that you've posed. I do think it's possible to think of dreams as thoughts that we often find difficult to remember. However, our thoughts probably exist on a continuum from those that are fully formed in the cortex and those that are swimming up from what Freud would have called the unconscious and what we might think of as deeper brain structures. Most of what most of us would call waking thoughts are verbal, like we're talking to ourselves. And those waking thoughts tend to be fairly logical in their syntax and structure. Dreams, on the other hand, are largely visual, not logical in the usual sense, and more driven by emotion and conflict. Most of the dreams we recall that are dreamlike take place during REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, so brain activity during dreaming is quite different than it is during waking thought. And when people are awakened during non-REM sleep, they often report dreams that are not dreamlike, but much more like waking thought. So that's not a terribly complete answer, but it might suggest some lines for further reading. Someone who studied this sort of thing quite extensively is Dr. Ernest Hartmann, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, and he has something like 345 publications. You can find his bibliography on the asdreams.org website. You might start there. And I think that'll wrap it up for email for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. You're also encouraged to leave voice messages on our website by clicking on the My Chingo logo. And you'll find that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And in the U.S., you can leave a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Anna, the man, for his thoughts and good example on love. And once again, a very happy birthday to his wife, Rachel. Please join us for our next show, which will be with one of the pioneers of the dream work movement, Dr. Gail Delaney. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.